This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and it's Friday, the 23rd of August, 2019. It's day five of Listener Week on Woman's Hour. I just want to remind you of one or two voices you might have missed, particularly, of course, if you've been fortunate enough to be away on holiday. This was from earlier in the week. This is Anne. She's now 70, and here she is on Woman's Hour talking about the moment she realised she had to end her 47-year marriage.
I don't think I realised quite how unhappy I was until I was away from home and I was doing something a bit different. And I realised that I was happy. And it was a feeling that I realised that I hadn't had for a very long time. And when I was back at home, I thought, no, there is happiness out there. And I really need to find that feeling again. And there's only one way of doing it.
Well, that was Anne from earlier in the week, and she ended up, of course, getting divorced and says life is now better for her. So if you missed Anne, you can catch up with her via BBC Sounds. And later in the week, Gwyneth, who is 19, talked to us about street harassment.
There was a point last summer where I was out with two of my friends and there was this crazy guy. He grabbed my friend's thigh and then we, like, shouted at him and he burst out laughing. And then the next day, I can't remember what it was that was shouted at us, but it was quite gross. And then when I went home, I put on, like, a long T-shirt and, like, trousers and I was like, I'm dressing like this for the rest of the summer because I can't. Like, it's just, it's too much.
Well, that was Gwyneth. She was in conversation with her younger sister and her mum and they all talked about what it was like to be a young woman just living her life, walking along the street, doing her thing and getting what amounted some days to just about constant hassle. So many of you were really angry about what you heard Gwyneth say and I know she's had a lot of support. If you missed her, make sure you catch up with that episode as well. But everything we've talked about on the programme this week has been because you wanted us to do it. And today is no exception. We're talking in a moment about mothers and sons. Later in the programme, renting when you're older, some of the complications and the challenges that that presents, and cooking after bereavement. If you've been perhaps the person who cooked for maybe four or five people every night of the week and then you find yourself preparing a meal just for yourself, that can be tough. So we'll talk about that on Woman's Hour this morning as well. First of all, Tricia is here and her son, James. Tricia, James, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being here, Tricia. I'm just going to read your email, if that's all right, Tricia.
Okay.
I would like to explore mothers' relationships with their adult sons, so often negatively stereotyped. Why can't mothers enjoy spending time with their sons in a similar way to daughters? I have both, and I equally love meeting my son for dinner, trips to the theatre, etc. I think this should be celebrated and not considered unmanly behaviour on his behalf. What used to be termed as him being a mother's boy. I think it's so prejudicial. My son doesn't think so, nor does his girlfriend. But what do other people think? Well, we're putting that one out there at BBC Women's Hour on social media, Twitter or Instagram. Or you can email us, of course, whenever you like via the website. Tricia, it took me by surprise, that email. I wasn't really expecting this to crop up. How long had you been thinking about this?
I suppose I've been thinking about it on and off for quite a long time, but recently a friend of mine was adopting a baby, and it was a boy. And then she said, oh, it's a real shame, because, you know, she really was really happy about adopting
the
baby.
Yeah.
But then she said, you know, the thing is, I won't have the relationship you have with your daughter when you grow up, and it's so lovely. And I said, well, why do you think that? And she said, oh, well, you can do things together. And I said, oh, well, I do things with James as well, so I think it's kind of the same thing. And she said, oh, well, he won't have the same interest as you because he's a boy. And I said, well, not all you know, men have the same interests as not all women have the same interests. It's like not all girls like makeup and fashion, you know, and boys might like makeup and fashion, not that James does.
And in his case, though.
But, you know, so I thought that was a real shame. And then I thought, you know, and sort of suppose through the time that's gone on, there's been a few instances where, like, I don't know if you want to say about Edinburgh, James.
Well, what happened in Edinburgh, James?
So we went to the Fringe Festival last weekend, and Mum and I went to a show, and we got told to sit in the front row. I was like, oh no, it's going to be some awful like audience participation. Anyway, they kind of played out this scene in which I was the boyfriend of the performer, and we had to like do this awkward interaction. Anyway, before this, she kept giving me kind of evil stares as part of the performance. And I was thinking, I really, really hope they don't think that my mum is my girlfriend, and they kind of bring her into it.
Was that going through your mind as well, Tricia?
Well, a little bit, yes, because it has happened before.
So
I remember one day I was going through a very stressful time, and I've done the same thing with my daughter. Sometimes we've gone away because I'm divorced, so I brought them up on my own, all of this, or the dad. But basically, you know, we'd go away if my daughter had a bad breakup or something, we'd go away and kind of have a nice fun time together to try and sort of bond, you know, and feel good about life. Anyway, James had a sort of going through a very stressful time, and I remember saying, oh, let's go away to this hotel in the countryside or whatever and visit some places. And I remember going, and this woman, it was horrific, and this woman sort of took us up to the bedroom, and it was like a double bedroom or something. And she and I said, oh gosh, you know, James is my son. And she'd made this assumption, you know, and I think people don't normally, I mean, I was saying this to somebody at work the other day, and they were saying, oh, people always made that assumption about fathers and daughters. It could be a bit iffy, you know.
I suppose so, yeah.
But people kind of never used to say that about sons and daughters, and I don't know.
I want to hear whether, are people really judging the intensity of your relationship with your son? Because I've only known you for half an hour, but
yeah,
it seems a perfectly natural relationship, yours, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It's not intense or anything.
No,
it's completely normal. I just don't think. I think, you know, like, you know, when you have a son, it's almost, especially if you stay married, because I think often you fall into that stereotype. So, you know, you talk earlier in the week about, you know, bringing up boys, but I often think, you know, whatever, you know, often the boy will go off and do sort of boyish things with the dad, like sporting type activity stereotypically, and the woman will go off and doing sort of stereotypical things with the daughter, you know. And I think sometimes, you know, people still think in those stereotypes even when their children go older.
Mm.
You know, I've talked to someone, you know, I said, what do you do with your dad? And she said, well, not really. What do you do with your dad, you know? But I said, do you spend much time together when you were young? And she said, all the time. She did, because she was an only child. But somehow, almost when you get to adulthood, it's like boys don't spend time with their mums, because it's a bit sort of
I wonder whether,
unmanly.
Yeah, you tell me what you think, James, whether perhaps if your parents are divorced, you might have a slightly different relationship with each parent, if you're fortunate, and many people do have perfectly decent relationships with both their mums and their dads after divorce. But it can be perhaps a more interesting relationship, actually.
I think so. So my parents divorced when I was about 10, and I did have to go through this strange period of understanding both of them as kind of individuals rather than just mum and dad, my parents. And I think every adult does that, whether their parents are together or not, but it tends to happen a bit later in life that you understand them as kind of a three-dimensional person. But when I was 10, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to have to spend 3 days with my dad now, and it's just like me and him and my sister as well. And then I'd go back to spend time with my mum, and I'd see her. And obviously it was a slightly stressful, difficult time, so I saw them in both quite vulnerable states. So I was kind of aware of them as kind of individuals, and individuals with which I'd have to form kind of distinctive, like unique bonds, not just a pair of them.
Mm, I think that's interesting. On Twitter, Julie says, I'm a mum of three grown-up boys. We love going out together. Stereotypes never cross my mind. Don't we complicate things? I don't think it's even gone through their minds. Luke says, I'm a mummy's boy and I don't care what anyone thinks. She's always been an amazing mother and we share a lot of interests. Do your partners ever ask you about your relationship with your mum, or do they simply take it for granted, James?
I think my current relationship girlfriend is absolutely fine about it. I think it's been a source of like jokes in the past, in that I do have quite a close relationship with my mum, and there is always there's this kind of popular myth of a mummy's boy, and almost like there's a conflict between your partner and your mother. And in the past, girlfriends have been like, oh, well, I think that you're too close to your mum, in a kind of jokey way. But I don't know whether there was kind of underpinning of like reality to that, whether there was an actual source of tension or not. I just don't know.
No, I think you're probably right to just question whether there was any. I suppose it's a territorial thing, isn't it? I mean, yeah. I always say to I've got daughters, but I always say to them, you know, nobody will love you like I do. Don't understand. Nobody will. And of course, there is an element of truth.
Absolutely. But I suppose I do think it is something different with mothers and sons. I mean, it's really positive on Twitter there, but I still feel that it's not so normal as going out with daughters. I mean, it's really celebrated, isn't it? You're talking about, you know, Prosecco, you're celebrating motherhood. But I think there's something really about celebrating the mothers and daughters. You know, you go to any sort of bottomless Prosecco lunch or something, and it's all women, and often with you know, mothers as well. And I just think, you know, how often do you see a sort of... you wouldn't see mothers and sons celebrated in that kind of flashy way.
They should be. What's wrong with doing it?
Yes, absolutely.
Here's a good email from a listener who says, a couple of years ago, I visited my 20-something son for the weekend while his wife was away on a business trip. A neighbour reported to my daughter-in-law the following week that she thought my son, very sadly, was having an affair. She had seen us laughing together after returning from seeing a film.
Oh, gosh.
There's a neighbourhood net curtain twitching
reaction. Absolutely.
And jumping to completely the wrong conclusion. So you're not going to change anything, are you, Tricia? Why should you?
No. Oh, no, not definitely not going to change anything. I just thought it was something worth thinking about, and I think there should be more equality, and they should be more, you know, celebrate your you know, time with your son and in society and things.
Here's Julia on Twitter. My only child is my son. He's 25. He's a thespian and in a happy relationship with a lovely French fellow. We've got a fantastic relationship. We talk every day and enjoy theatre, cafe visits, etc. We argue and we laugh together. It is real and wonderfully special. That sounds incredibly positive.
Yes.
I suppose I was a bit... not, I suppose, troubled, actually, wouldn't be too strong a word, by your friend at the very beginning who is adopting a boy and seemed to have this very, very, well, very set idea of what the future might hold. Yeah. You don't know, do you?
No, you don't know. But I think people still do make that assumption. I think people, there's that old adage, isn't it, that, you know, you have a girl and she's with you for life, you have a son until he gets married. Isn't that something like that?
A daughter's a daughter all of her life.
Yes, yes.
And a son until...
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think maybe in the past there was an element of truth in that.
Yeah.
Maybe. Less so now.
I think it probably is there a little bit now, but we live in a society where we think we've overcome it and therefore it's not talked about. I mean, it's interesting coming on here and speaking about this because I hadn't really thought about it overtly before. But when Mum mentioned it to me, I thought, oh, actually, maybe I myself carry some of these prejudices. Mm. And when I see a mother and a son out in the street, I think, oh, is that a little bit weird? And I have to kind of correct myself. And I just don't think there are many good role models in popular culture. I was thinking the other day that there's this show called Gilmore Girls, which I really like. Yeah. And that's a fantastic depiction of a mother-daughter relationship in all its complexity. And I couldn't think of a male equivalent. I mean, you think of Psycho, you think of Oedipus, things like this. But I jumped to because I was like, what? Like, where are the positive role models? And obviously that's the kind of fear that underpins it all. But
well, yeah, maybe there's also an element of you, Tricia, underestimating yourself and thinking, why would this busy young man want to spend time with dreary old me? Which you clearly...
Yeah.
Do you think maybe you are overthinking this?
No, I don't think I am overthinking it. No, I really don't think so. No, I don't. I think, because I think that is true. I don't think there are many good popular kind of, you know, examples in the media of, you know, it's like the old thing, isn't it? I think it'd be fine if a daughter, you talk about housing later, but it'd be fine if a daughter stayed at home forever. But I was very aware that James was thinking, oh my God, when he came back from university and studying, he came back for a little while because he was doing a PhD, but it was like, oh my God, he's still at home. And I think he felt that very demasculating because obviously I do fuss. I fuss about my daughter, you know, breakfast in bed and all that, you know, when I'm treating them and stuff like that. But I think, you know, I just feel you had a sense, didn't you, that it's not manly to still be at home, especially because I'm a single parent, you know, living with your mum kind of thing.
Hannah says, I see it as a positive thing, men having good relationships with their mothers. The idea of hashtag mother's boy just reinforces a negative stereotype, and we see too much of the monster-in-law image played for laughs. Yeah, I guess that is still going. I don't know. I think you two have got something brilliant, and I'm sure you have with your daughter as well.
Oh, Tricia. Yeah, definitely. And we really work well as a threesome. And yeah, so I think, yeah, we have good. So I suppose it's a celebration too, isn't it? Wanting to really celebrate our positive relationship and encourage other people, I think.
And Sue on Twitter is a little bit jealous. I wish I had the kind of mum-son thing that you're describing. I get on so well with my daughter-in-law and their kids are great. But if I get a text from my son, it's astonishing. I am so envious.
Aww.
You see, I think sometimes that it's almost as though parents occasionally believe that daughters owe them their time, but they're more grateful that their sons give them any time. Sometimes, I think.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thought.
It's just a thought. I'm just throwing it in there.
Well, I certainly don't think I feel like that.
I suppose for me, it emanates again out of the kind of separation. I felt a kind of, not partially a duty, I suppose, but also something that I wanted to do is to kind of cultivate relationships with both. And I felt that it was just as important to make time to see my dad and my mum individually rather than focusing on one or the other.
Well, I've been really interested to hear from you both, actually. It's been fascinating. I think it's setting people thinking about this. We're getting a lot of tweets on this, so thank you both.
That's good.
Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you.
And when's your next outing? Where are you going next?
I think maybe we're meeting tomorrow. It's my sister's birthday coming up.
Yeah.
Just to reassure me, you did get on badly with her when you were a teenager, didn't you?
Oh, awful.
Just checking in on that one. Thank you, James. All the best. Now, on Monday, it's Bank Holiday Monday, of course, Tina Dehealy is here with Woman's Hour. She's talking about women in construction. Currently, women make up just 16% of the UK construction workforce. And it's 2 million, the UK construction workforce. So what is being done to change that? I know Tina has got some cracking voices who will be part of Bank Holiday Monday's edition of Woman's Hour. Now, we're going to talk about private renting when you're a little older. This is something, of course, that is becoming increasingly common, and it was suggested by a listener called Karen. We'll hear from her in a moment. Also with us, Polly Neat, who is the CEO of Shelter. Welcome to you, Polly. And Georgie Laming of Generation Rent. And Georgie, you were set up to be the national voice of private renters. That's right, isn't
it?
You yourself are a renter?
Yeah.
And your mum is also renting a property?
Yeah, my mum's renting, yeah.
Okay. And Karen, you're our listener. Move a little closer to the microphone. It's great to have you on the programme. Are you all right if I just read some of your email?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I'm writing to you because I can't believe my husband and I are alone in finding ourselves in our late 50s living in rental accommodation as a consequence of the economic downturn. For people of our generation, the generation who have on the whole prospered as a consequence of the commodification of property, we are the forgotten outliers. Is that how you continue to see yourselves, as outliers?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I think because our generation, as a general rule, we're the Thatcher's children, aren't we? So we were 20 years old when we first bought our property and had mortgages continuously from that point until things started to go wrong for us in our 50s. And most people of our generation are still homeowners. And as being someone that's in rental accommodation as a consequence of lots of different unfortunate circumstances that all came together at the same time, we dropped off the housing ladder, an expression I completely hate, but it is a housing ladder.
Yeah.
And I said, another thing I said in my email, that I sort of feel like a dirty little secret amongst the so-called middle classes because we're not talked about. So I go about life, generally speaking, keeping my circumstances to myself. And if anybody asks, I'll tell them. But you get this slight recoil. It's barely perceptible.
Do you really get that?
Oh, really, really. not amongst friends, who are wonderful, but people who see you as different to them and somehow, I don't know, do they find me a bit scary? Maybe, because my circumstances are quite alien to them.
It's all a little bit uncertain and shaky.
It is.
Yes, OK.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, actually, as we'll discuss, it can be. Renting can be exactly that. Okay. Do you mind just telling us a little bit more about, without going into huge detail, obviously it's very personal, but about what went wrong?
Well, we moved house in 2005. Yeah. We moved to a property that we took on as a project with self-employed people. We didn't have a pension, so like lots of people, we bought properties, renovated them, moved on. We had a very clear plan. It was a 10-year plan to renovate the property, downsize, have a low mortgage, be mortgage-free by the time we were 65. We had it all mapped out.
Well, I think a lot of people had very similar thoughts, didn't they?
That's yeah. exactly right. We had a 2-year fixed term, which took us to 2007. And at the end of that, we renegotiated our mortgage. That was really peak for mortgages being incredibly flexible. So self-employed people were able to self-certify, which for us felt fine because we had good levels of income that fluctuated throughout the year. But we had a mortgage repayment schedule that was absolutely manageable on every level. We fixed it for 5 years. 2007, 5-year fix. What could possibly go wrong? Well, Northern Rock went wrong.
Yeah.
In 2008, everything came tumbling down. We thought we were safe because we had a fixed mortgage. But when it came to the end of the fix, we went on to a standard variable rate. We couldn't remortgage because the mortgage market had completely constricted and got rid of all the products that would have helped us.
And so you had to sell at a time when
the market was flat, completely flat, and we had a forced sale, really. Repossession was on the agenda. We couldn't make our mortgage payments. They had trebled.
Right, oh, crikey, right. So yeah. At a time when you wouldn't have expected it, your comfortable life, because I'm guessing it was
pretty
comfortable,
it was great, yeah.
You were put into a situation you weren't used to, a world you didn't know much about.
Well, I'd lived a fairly sort of itinerant lifestyle as a child through lots of ups and downs. So, you know, I was a fairly tough cookie, but this was a really difficult time. We had young adult children. My husband's business had taken a bit of a clobbering because of the economic downturn, and we were just vulnerable, yeah. and we were fighting on all corners. So trying to sell a house in a flat market with quite a large mortgage was an incredibly stressful situation. But actually, we did sell it. We avoided repossession, and we left with no debt, but also with no savings, no pension, nothing.
And you anticipate, do you, that you'll be renting for the rest of your life?
Yes.
Polly, I'm just looking at Twitter, actually, which has just burst into life with people talking about this. So yeah. You've hit on something here, Karen. You've probably heard stories very similar to Karen's over the years.
Yeah, unfortunately. And the number of over 55s renting privately has increased by 74% over the last 10 years. So this is a growing issue. And it's really throwing into sharp relief the problems with instability in the private rented sector. It really is very insecure as a sector for lots of reasons. No-fault evictions being one.
Define a no-fault eviction.
So a no-fault eviction is where a landlord can basically ask you to leave at very short notice. After you've been there for 6 months, you can be asked to leave for no reason. So it's called no fault because you don't have to have missed your rent or damaged the property or anything like that. Mm. You can just be out on your ear, basically. And for older people, that is a really intolerable level of insecurity. Plus the fact that as you get older still, what we're seeing at Shelter is that when people need aids and adaptations to their home, private renting is completely unsuitable.
Why? What happens?
Well, because it isn't, landlords don't want to make aids and adaptations. It just isn't appropriate. If you own your home or if you're in social housing, it's a completely different story. But if you're in private renting, older people are afraid to ask for anything or complain about anything. Karen's nodding here. Because they're worried that they will get a revenge no-fault eviction if they do complain or or if they ask for anything to be changed in the property.
All right. I mentioned Twitter, so I'm just going to read a couple of tweets out. I work with my... Oh, no, sorry, that's a different one. Let me. I have rented my entire life, says Catherine. I'm 56 in a few days. I have never been able to afford to buy, and there are lots of people in my position. The assumption that we can all afford to buy or even want to, but that's another debate, is maddening. And from Iona, I'm in private rented accommodation. I work full time. I can't see a point when I will ever be able to retire, as my housing costs will only ever go up. Right, Georgia, is that true for a start? That seems such a gloomy assessment.
Yeah, I think that when you poll over 40s, they believe that they will never be able to buy a house if they're renting now. And I think that's pretty accurate.
And that their rent will just keep on going up.
Yeah.
Because so they can't stop work.
Especially if, like Polly says, you have a no-fault eviction and you're going back onto the market, rent will have gone up during the time that you have been in a different property. So... really, there's not much choice out there for renters. The best thing you can do is stay in one rented accommodation for as long as possible. And that's what I'd advise any older renter to do, is to ask for the longest contract you can.
How long might you get?
Well, it's completely undefined. So most contracts are 12 months, but I would advise that people ask for at least 2 years when they first start.
Wow. I mean, when you get to, so I'm in mid, you know, 55, 12 months goes like that. You need,
yeah.
Karen, do you mind me asking how long you can stay in your current place for?
Well, I'm incredibly fortunate. As I said in my original email, I have a wonderful landlord with a great relationship, and the chances are that I can stay there long term. But that's only the chances are, because yeah. I'm subject to the same regulations as everybody else. And whilst you can, in the beginning, ask for 12, 24 months, that's not the norm. The norm mm-hmm. is an assured short-hold tenancy yeah. with yeah. a six-month period guaranteed, pretty much. And after that, you're on 1 month's notice. And that could be for the rest of your life.
This is so concerning, Polly.
Yeah.
And it really messes with people's minds, doesn't it?
It's really... for a lot of people that we see at shelter, and obviously that is the sharp end, but it is intolerable. I mean, the psychological pressures that it causes are intolerable. And, you know, we see people whose circumstances have perhaps changed quite suddenly, often women after a divorce, or even women leaving an abusive relationship, who suddenly find themselves in this position. And it is extremely insecure and difficult. And, you know, there is really only one answer to it for the long term, which is we must build social housing. It's absolutely critical that the government invests in social housing that people on lower incomes can afford, and that can provide a base for younger adults to save, so that potentially they could get on the so-called housing ladder. Because at the moment, the other issue about renting is that you can't save any money. So two-thirds of private renters... Yeah, two-thirds of private renters have no savings at all, right? So the thing about never getting on the home ownership ladder is absolutely right. And, you know, we do need to look at much lower rent homes, by which I mean social housing.
I'm just going to read this email from a listener, Anonymous. I'm 50 and renting with my partner. We both had houses, but divorce and work issues meant that before we met, we had to give up the houses and get into renting. If we hadn't met 5 years ago, we'd both still be renting rooms in shared houses, as property in our area is just out of our price range. Shared houses are soul destroying. I felt humiliated when I was living in a room. People looked at me like I was a failure. Thank God we are at least together and can now afford to rent a flat. Georgie, many of us in the past have lived in shared houses, bedsits. What about that? Sharing a house can be soul destroying.
I live in a shared house, so I hope my housemates aren't listening. No, I think it is. It can be soul destroying because of those things that we associate with home, right? Being able to put art on the walls, being able to leave your stuff in a shared living room, having a living room. Most HMOs, kind of big shared houses, you'll be lucky if you do have a place to relax that isn't the bedroom.
But I suppose most of us perhaps have done that in our 20s.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be keen to do it now.
No, absolutely not. And the listener is absolutely right. If you don't have a partner, that's probably what you're looking at, or a bedsit, studio, flat situation, and they're still not cheap. I think there's a real issue, a kind of a mental health issue with what do, especially I think older women like you saying, Polly, going through divorce, if you don't have family that you can rely on, where do you go? And I think that does put a massive pressure on families. You know, I'm my mum's guarantor on her flat. So if anything goes wrong with my mum, I have to help her, but I also live in a shared house. And I think that's what we're going to see with this kind of ageing population of renters, is it just the pressure increasing.
You were telling me a bit about your mum and your stepdad, isn't it? And they live in a part of, do you mind me saying where they live?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they live in Lowestoft, and you were just saying that they are typical. They're both were in work, but they're people who, they literally don't have the time to engage with this sort of conversation we're having now because they'll be too busy.
Yeah.
But they're right, they are the people who are talked about, but they don't hear it. Because they're too busy, in a way, they're too busy suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. They both work 40-hour weeks. My stepdad works in a factory, my mum works in a care home. There is no way that they can engage in these conversations and get advice. There's no way that they can make plans and budgets and save for a new rented home at all. And I do worry about them. I worry about being a guarantor for them when I'm paying something like, I'm paying about 30% of my income on rent, and they probably are paying about 60% of their income on rent. So if any of them get ill, I don't know what will happen.
Go on, Karen.
Can I just say that psychologically, if you think about that as a parent, having your child as your guarantor just to have a roof over your head,
well, it's a slice of life,
isn't it? Torturous, really.
Yeah. But I bet it's not uncommon these days.
I'm sure it isn't. And I think the other thing that Georgie mentioned earlier is the upwards only thing. If you have to move on, for whatever reason, your landlord wants the premises back, you have no choice, no right of appeal, you have to move on. The chances of you finding comparable accommodation for an even vaguely similar price in lots of parts of the country are zero. And not only that, you have to go through such stringent checks that are often driven by algorithms that have all sorts of data checks. It's incredibly dehumanising. So if, like us, my husband and I ended up with a ruined credit score 2 years before, we had a straight A situation where people hand over fist were wanting to lend us money.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, I can tell you for sure now, if we had to move out, we would struggle to find any landlord that could get insurance on us. We would be an uninsurable risk because we don't tick the right boxes. And that is absolutely dehumanising for everybody.
Polly?
Well, just to go back to Georgie's mum and stepdad, I mean, they should be in a council house, right? Decades ago, that's where they would have been. It would have been long-term. It would have been secure. It would have been a nice place. It would have been not a residualised, stigmatised form of accommodation as social housing has become, but something totally acceptable, normal for people who are on lowish incomes.
Apparently, sure, I've just been told short tenancies have been abolished in Scotland.
That's right.
Maybe that should be something that should happen in the rest of the country.
Yes, well, the previous government said they were going to abolish Section 21, so essentially abolish this whole 6 month and then 1 month's notice thing. And we would really urge the new government to follow through on that. They've been a bit quiet on it. We would like to urge them to follow through on that and end Section 21 and also invest in social housing.
But at the moment, the national conversation is consumed by one thing and one thing only. And I guess that what we're talking about today is an illustration of what's actually going on
exactly
out there, impacting on lives everywhere.
Yeah.
It just gets forgotten.
But at some point, the government are going to have to pivot onto a domestic agenda, and they're going to be faced with a desperately disunited country. Mm. And housing is at the heart of that.
Yeah.
It's got to be addressed really soon.
Thank you, Polly, and thank you, Georgie. And perhaps we can talk more in the podcast. But Karen, that's been brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank
and we'll
Jo.
Come back to you a little bit later. But so many people are sending positive thoughts to you and absolutely empathising with the fact that you want to talk about this subject. So thank you very much
for that.
Right, now this is Women's Hour. It's Listener Week. So everything we're talking about on the programme this week, throughout the week, has been suggested by you. And our next contributor is in our studio in Bristol, and it's Susie. Susie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jane.
I'm really glad to be able to have you on the programme because you are somebody, I think, who contacted us a bit of a time ago now. Is that right?
Yes, it was a while back. Yeah.
Okay, and I've got your email here, so I'm just going to read it, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm a mother of five children, now all grown up and flown the nest. I always had a full-time job and a lovely husband. Family meals were very important, and however stretched for time I was, I always seemed to be happily producing copious amounts of food for everybody. Now, sadly, my husband died last year after a long illness, and as a result, I have no pleasure in eating alone. I never cook, as cooking is a work of love for sharing, and I just wonder how other people adapt. Well, thank you for that, because I think a lot of people, I know already, because I'm looking at some emails we've had on the subject, people are interested in this. How have things changed for you, Susie? I mean, obviously, in terms of the loss of your partner, I'm thinking more about when you get home at night, you go into the kitchen, and you feel what exactly?
Well, absolutely no appetite at all. I mean, I go into the kitchen, my family nag me and phone me up and sort of say, have you eaten today, Mum? But there's just no interest in it. So, I mean, for example, I will never cook myself an evening meal. I've tried to move on. I've sort of tried to attack it another way and invite friends round, and then I'm delighted to cook for them. I'm very lucky and I have lots of people who invite me out, which is very nice. So when I'm out and about, I enjoy my food and that's not a problem. But I just cannot bring myself to cook for myself. I just think it's a waste of time. And I think half of it is the fact that I just have no appetite. And I can go into shops. I'm very lucky. I live in a lovely village which has lots of lovely shops with, you know, fishmonger, deli, that kind of thing. And I will go in and I will look at the food to buy it. And I actually physically makes me nauseous.
You recoil.
I just can't do it. Yeah. I absolutely recoil. It's a good word for it, yeah.
Right. Well, Jane Clark is here, who's a nutritionist. And you have a website called Nourish, don't you, Jane?
I do.
So I totally get this. I haven't been bereaved like Susie, but I understand that cooking for yourself is a different sort of cooking, isn't it?
It is. And I think in this country, we're particularly bad. You know, we've lost the connection between looking after ourselves and food being a vital part of that. You know, in Mediterranean countries, you know, it could be a simple pasta that we might just be so used to just throwing together. But in this country, a lot of people are living on their own, whether they're bereaved, as sadly Susie is, or they're disconnected and they just don't have friends that they could invite round. Mm. And it has an enormous impact on our appetite, because emotions do affect our appetite. You know, we're sick to the stomach.
Yes,
pupils have gone
really
through.
Are.
Yeah, we're anxious, and we don't then have a natural instinct to say, "I'll eat more," when actually that's when the body does need more.
Susie, do you eat so-called normally when you're with friends, or is it simply when you're thinking about just cooking for yourself that the problem starts?
Normally, with friends, I don't have a problem, and I have a job in that takes me out a lot, and I have to eat out, which is great because it means I'm getting the food intake. But certainly on my own, I just absolutely have no appetite. I mean, you know, it'll be 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'll suddenly think, oh, perhaps I should have had something to eat today. You know, it just doesn't occur to me.
What does she do then, Jane?
Well, Susie, I think one of the expectations we have in this country is that we're meant to have this large evening meal. Mm. And, like, I think appetite is a bit like bringing up a child. If you put a large thing in front of them and say, this is what I'd like you to do, they'll do the opposite. And the same happens with food. That actually, if you expect yourself to go to the table, have a meal, as you say, you recoil. But actually, a lot of the people that I look after, whether you've lost your way through bereavement and isolation or your body's really going through a tough health challenge, is actually to play the opposite and serve something in a small ramekin or on a small plate. And actually, you look at it and go, well, that's not enough to keep a mouse alive, let alone myself. And what the body goes is, oh, but I might actually need a little bit more. So I think let's look at it in a different way and serve small things. And Susie, it could be, yeah, other listeners out there, just have a main meal at lunchtime and then take the pressure off the evening. You know, when I was brought up, my mum would serve cheese on toast as an evening meal, or egg on toast, or, you know, one of my childhood favourites was something called cheese fluff. And that was when you simply just take a slice of toast on one side, you break an egg, separate it out into the yolk, whisk a little bit of cheese into it, whisk the meringue and serve it as a cheese fluff on toast, pop it under the grill. And it's simple things like that. If we take the expectation off ourselves, appetite is more likely to return.
Mm. Do you associate particular meals with people, perhaps with your late husband, Susie? Is that part of the problem?
Probably. I mean, interestingly enough, you say about the small meals. I mean, for example, I always have a cup of coffee and a piece of toast for breakfast. And it dawned on me this morning as I was doing it, is that we never actually had breakfast together. So therefore, that hasn't changed.
Ah, okay.
So that's, you know, that seems sort of quite normal to me. So I don't have a problem with that. Mm. But certainly lunch or an evening one, you know, after work, one would sit down and I would spend quite a bit of time doing something. I mean, you know, we really enjoyed food and it was special. And so it just, I just don't do it at all. And I think also it's the eating alone.
Yes.
It's the sitting down, you know, eating on your own. You're not having a chat. You know, I can't, you try and read a book with it or you watch the television with it or something, but it's just sort of mechanical. It has no joy in it at all.
So what do you do, actually? Would it be the telly or a bit of music? What do you do?
Yes, well, I sort of just flaff about. I don't really sit down and eat anything. Oh, so I will, I'll carry on, you know, a lot of ironing goes done.
Right.
A lot of flat things.
Can I just read out some emails? Because we've had a lot on this. A listener called Jean says, I'm a widow, have been for 4 years, and one for whom family meals was everything I was about. I no longer even think about what I'll eat. Either I just grab anything in the cupboard or I don't bother. Well, Jean, please don't. Not, you must bother. Plus, when family do visit, she says, I find timing the meal no longer instinctive. I don't know. Perhaps just, I suppose, out of practice is what Jean means there. Another listener says, my husband died 6 years ago when my children had just turned 9 and 6. The thing is, the meals just have to keep coming. My relationship with food and cooking has completely changed. I used to be a foodie and always waited for the kids to go to bed so I could eat something nice with my husband. I do sometimes cook endless chilies and spag bowls. Sometimes my stomach is churning when I cook, as I'm literally quite sick of the sight of food. You're right, Jane. This is all so emotional, isn't it?
Yeah.
There is that fantastic book, Gut, which I recommend to everybody. I don't know if you've read it. Julia Enders, I think, is the author. But what do they say about the stomach? It's the something, the connection with
it's
the brain.
It's our second brain.
Our second brain, that's right. Yeah.
So emotions affect the stomach, but also what we eat affects our brain, which is the other way that we possibly could help some people in thinking that actually if we can put a small amount, then we start to feel stronger in ourselves. And another one I've always loved is smoked mackerel. So just get packets of smoked mackerel. You can freeze them, get one out, just thaw a fillet, mix it in with a bit of yoghurt and something that has that slight smoky flavour just with some raw vegetables or actually frozen vegetables. We have this misnomer in this country that frozen is bad. It's not. If you can stock the freezer up with frozen vegetables. One I do when I get back late from work is steam some spinach, peas, broad beans, then bung them in a bowl, drizzle some olive oil over, a dollop of hummus. And sometimes actually when you serve it in a small bowl, it looks appetizing because again, it's that big plate, knife and fork. Mm. Have a hot bath or baked eggs is another one that you can do.
Would you, I mean, the ready meal, they're ubiquitous, aren't they? They're actually not cheap either, we need to say. Are they a curse or can they be helpful?
They can be helpful. I don't think we should curse them. I think one of the problems we have with ready meals is that the food brigade have started shouting and saying we shouldn't have too much salt, you know, and actually salt gives our food flavour. And I think a lot of people get so disempowered and disinspired with food that actually something with a little bit of sea salt sparks the taste buds. And if we get the taste buds engaging with some flavour, that again will start to spark that little bit of I can eat. Because if all food is all bland, it's boring and we all lose our way.
Jane, thank you so much for helping us out today. And Susie, all the very best to you. You've really struck a chord with people. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
And there'll be links, I'm sure, on the Woman's Hour website. Suzanne has emailed Jane, so I'll just read this. I lost my husband 2 years ago as well, and I felt just as your contributor did about eating alone. But now I've come to realise that cooking for love does include loving myself, and I now concentrate on really healthy eating for me, and I'm almost ready to cook for friends again. I do wish her good luck with positive vibes about being good to herself now. Thank you. That was a listener called Suzanne. I think that's very kind of you. And we did have a few people just saying, oh, Susie needs to work for charities. I mean, she's just lost her husband and, give the woman a break. However, most of you, of course, were extremely sympathetic. Jane says, my husband died nearly 5 years ago. We'd enjoyed our food and I cooked all the time and we'd entertained a lot during a 35-year marriage. Now I use my interest in food as an activity. When I cook for myself, I make sure I eat good quality ingredients. It doesn't have to be expensive. I ensure the food is fresh, it's presented well, looks colourful and appetising and healthy. I invite friends for lunch and for suppers and tea and cake. And this helps fill the gap of cooking for my husband and allows me to take pleasure in cooking for others again. Catherine says, I really identify with this. My life has been transformed by meal kit deliveries. Half my problem was summoning up the energy to think what to eat and the shopping. But having a weekly food delivery that I have to prepare myself does take all the pressure off and has made a big difference to me. Yeah, it's not the cheapest way of going about it, but I have heard other people recommend that, Catherine. And from Anne, I've lived alone for many years and I love creating lovely meals. My allotment helps as fresh veg is so inspiring. Also, I can afford better ingredients than when I eat out. So Georgie is still here and we also have Karen with us as well, our listener who was talking about renting when you were older. As I said during the programme, a lot of reaction to what you had to say, Karen. Myra says, I divorced. My husband kept the family home for a variety of reasons. I've lived in three different homes with my daughters over the past 3 years. We're about to go into our fourth. It agonises me that I cannot provide stability for them. Do you understand that?
Completely. Yeah. If there's the thing that really moves me most, perhaps, in all of this,
yeah,
is guilt about my children.
Right.
Because they are, of course, entering a world as young adults where the cost of housing is excruciatingly high in the city that they've called home for the last 30 years. And we can't be the bank of mum and dad. We are just about keeping our own heads above water. And that pot of equity that really is taken for granted because of the way house prices have grown is often sitting there to be passed down to children. And philosophically, I think that probably needs to change and will in the coming years. But most of my daughter and son's friends have parents who can help them out. And we can't. Mm. And I think you do feel guilt about that. Even though my children are wonderful and have no sense of being hard done by at all, as a mum and a dad,
it's bound to.
That's
yeah.
the thing that gets to me every time.
I think it's important. I should say I'm not from London. I'm from Liverpool. I go there regularly. I was there last weekend, and property is a lot cheaper.
Absolutely.
The south of England is just astronomical.
It is.
Value does exist in other places. And Catherine says, I live in Middlesbrough. There's no shortage of housing. Beautiful houses in wonderful locations. My husband and I are both graduates. We did live in another part of the country. But in our 30s, with our young children, we made a conscious decision to relocate. Houses here are relatively cheap. £300,000, for example, for a beautiful detached five-bedroom home. The sooner this country gets rid of the southeast-centric economy, the better. What else do I want to mention? So much stuff here. I'll bring you in back into the conversation as well, Georgie. Julia says, we have five children and lost out when we sold our house just before the financial crash. And while the deposits on buying triple overnight, we were left renting, and this was 11 years ago. Currently, and this is, we have spent £240,000 on rent alone, and we've been moved on six times by landlords wishing to sell. The stress has become unbearable, and sadly my husband and I now live apart, both renting, not happy about it in any way. The sadness is that, as Karen was saying, the sadness is the lack of an asset to leave to our lovely kids. We never thought we'd end this way. It's hard to know quite what to say, apart from being sympathetic, really, Georgie.
It's absolutely heartbreaking. And I think also, as someone who's 27, it doesn't paint a great picture for me, kind of growing up. I don't think that owning a house should be something that everyone has to do and as an aspiration. I think having more social housing is really what we need. And I think that's the big problem that Karen's been highlighting, right? That kind of shame, wanting to support your children, feeling like you're ostracised from maybe your friends. And that's because housing is something that we've been taught that we should be able to own later in life and that your whole life is working towards that. But if you're on low income or you've found hard times, the reality is you're not going to own a house. And so we need to start looking at making renting better. And I think that's the problem here, is that it's about renting being something that's better, that's more acceptable, that the government focus on, rather than it all being about home ownership.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people always do say when we have conversations like this, oh, well, the British are obsessed about home ownership. It's not the same on the continent of Europe. But I've always wondered who owns those properties in Europe that people rent? Somebody does and someone's making money. Is that...
Well, it's probably true. But, you know, I honestly think home ownership is quite often a misnomer, because I didn't ever own a home. I had,
a mortgage
on a house. Yeah. I didn't own anything. I was essentially paying a form of rent.
Yeah.
So I think what most of us want, if you really strip it down, is security of tenure and the ability to choose where you live. And I completely get what the listener from Middlesbrough said.
Yeah.
Middlesbrough has wonderful housing stock. My husband's family are from the northeast of England. Property is much cheaper there. But if you've made your life in the south, southeast, southwest, that's where your friends, that's where you've put roots down.
Yeah.
To have to move everything just because of the cost of housing, renting or otherwise, just doesn't feel right. And I think a home doesn't have to be owned by you. It just needs to be somewhere that you can take ownership of. So you can paint it the colour you want, you can have a couple of pets, you have a bit of a garden, nobody's going to complain if you put some pictures on the wall. It's that sense of ownership of your space, even if it is technically owned by someone else. It's security of tenure, and I don't think that has to be in the form of ownership. I think the whole model's broken. And it needs to be looked at.
Well, I think a lot of people, judging by what I've been reading and seeing on Twitter, a lot of people are with you. This is a real conversation shift now, but I just want to do it because I can. We were reminiscing about egg in a cup.
We were.
yes.
Marvellous segue, Jane.
Well, it was brilliant. Thank Karen, you're far too good at this. You've built here as a normal member of the public. I'm beginning to have my doubts. I know you listen to that terrible podcast that woman Fee Glover makes me do. Don't ever.
Well, Fee Glover's very good, Jane. Have you paid much attention to her?
I think she's really overrated.
You could perhaps learn a thing or two.
God, this is like a string of... Anyway, it's absolutely appalling. Georgie looked really baffled because she is a bit younger than the rest of us in the room. An egg in a cup was something that was routinely served up by your mother when you were ill in bed. And apparently you now give it to your kids as a hangover cure.
Well, we've moved beyond me giving it to them, but it is particularly my daughter, who is renowned for the quality of her hangovers, and she is listening to this on catch-up, possibly nursing a hangover.
Right.
Egg in a cup is her go-to.
I actually wouldn't do that. Jane?
No, I couldn't.
And my producer's bawling in my headphones. What is it? What's egg in a cup? So, egg in a cup is boiled eggs mashed up with a fork in a cup, isn't it?
With butter.
Yeah, with butter.
Oh, my God.
No, it's really crucial that you get the yolk properly set, but not hard boiled. If you get the texture right, it's a thing of beauty.
I can't think of anything worse on a hangover, to be honest.
OK, so what's your hangover cure then?
Oh, I think toast. I think just something nice and carby.
Well, Jane's our official nutritionist. What would you advise, Jane?
It is something protein rich. So actually, the egg does have a bit of science behind it. So it could be. But also, you know, a really quick, easy supper is baked eggs.
Yeah, you said baked. I'm not.
I like eggs.
I don't like baked eggs.
You don't?
No,
you?
I don't. No. And how? But just out of interest, as we're on the subject, how do you bake an egg?
You're really looking at me, going, oh, go on, tell me.
Yeah.
Well, baked eggs is ramekin and just bunging an egg in and into one or two eggs into a ramekin with a little bit of butter.
Yeah, you take it out the shell, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yes. That's true, actually. Crack them. And then you can put mushrooms, spinach, peas, sardines, something like that in. And then 10 minutes later in a warm oven, you've got a simple supper.
It's the sardines. You lost
I think you lost me at sardines.
Right, so Jane, we have to ask you now. What's your hangover cure?
Well, I get up. I take two Nurofen before I go to bed. And sorry, I shouldn't name a brand. I take a form of ibuprofen before I go to bed. And then I normally get up and take more. So that's brilliant. Right, thanks for that, Jane. You won't be entering the medical profession anytime soon. Thank you, Karen, very much, I suppose. No, thank you. She's a member of the public. I've got to be nice. And Jane, thank you for your fantastic advice this morning. And what I really, and Georgie too, of course. I think what we've done, what we've achieved this week is just to, I don't know, just make a connection, what people really want to hear about. And I hope, Karen, you've. What's it been like to come in? Is it weird?
It's been fabulous. And I don't say that lightly. Weird. No, because I think as a listener, if you've been listening as long as I have and you've been through lots of presenters, and you're a whippersnapper by Jenny Murray standards, Jane, if I may say.
Well, you can say it as often as you like.
But seeing behind the scenes and the care that's shown to people that contact the programme, I think is really lovely. That has been lovely.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. And I hope that encourages other people, because I really do mean this. We need you to tell us what you want us to talk about, because we often get people carping. I understand that completely. We are your programme. You pay for it. Tell us what you want us to talk about. Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And Tina Dahili is here on Monday morning with a programme about construction. And of course, the weekend edition, the best of the week, is tomorrow afternoon, Saturday afternoon, 4:02.
I'm Sheila Dillon, and before you go, I wanted to tell you about the Food Programme podcast, the place for hungry minds. In our latest episode, I sit down to talk to Jamie Oliver.
We used to go and pick sorrel and rucket on roundabouts. And I'm like, yeah, but Gennaro is kind of a lot of exhaust fumes around here, Gennaro. Lead, Gennaro, not good.
It was wonderful to hear that Jamie Oliver, master of Italian cooking, actually only encountered olive oil in his late teens.
My geography teacher, Mr. Saggers, said that I was deaf. In Essex, the only place to get olive oil was Boots.
So, subscribe to the Food Programme on BBC Sounds.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.